one of the reasons. just when I was training in meditation, just the gongs were something I'd never look forward to. Because either they were rung too early, and I was just really getting into some good meditation and gong. Or they were rang too late when I was really hurting, oh please ring the gong. It was like controlling the meditation, rather allowing the meditation to be this natural quietening and calming of the body and the mind, and going deep, 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 deep within. And sometimes the body and the mind just wanted to carry on going deep and just ringing the bell, just rah! And sometimes, yeah, I tell funny stories and jokes. One of the ones which always makes a point, what would happen if the Buddha had someone ringing a gong under the Bodhi tree while he was getting enlightened? Gong, bong, silence. It's more beautiful than any bell. But anyway, for today's talk, it's so often in this, when I want to give a talk, that I pick up on the audience which is here, and there's hardly any audience here at all tonight. They're all listening online, maybe. So it gives me more freedom. It's amazing, you may not believe this, but a few times I wanted to give a very deep talk, but the audience did not let me. And you could feel that happening, that the ideas were like blocks, because giving a talk is getting in connection with the audience, getting the relationship with them, and with kindness, with peace, with depth, to see what you could teach. But tonight, there's always one talk which I wanted to give, haven't given for a long time now. It was just on transcendence. It's a deep talk, it's actually going further than you've gone before. Sometimes I've told jokes about that, you know, like boldly going where no monk has gone before. So those people who know Star Trek, they say boldly go. This is boldly go. You know, it's just a little play on words. But being able to take one's understanding, one's experience, one's penetration to a much deeper level than you've ever done before, and to use that to experience things which you haven't experienced before. Wonderful, safe things, but also enlightening things. In order to do this, there's something which I was just giving a talk last night to a group of students in Monash University in Malaysia. And we're talking about mindfulness, and I'm going to start with mindfulness but go much deeper than ordinary mindfulness. And to say that mindfulness for most people is just ordinary, it allows you to be safe, it allows you to be maybe successful, but we don't take it far enough, we don't get into a transcendent state of mindfulness where we can be just so aware, deeply aware. And this is what happens to you when you start building up your meditation. And it's one of the reasons, one amongst many, why I prefer to do this half an hour meditation first and the talk afterwards. So that when I'm meditating deeply, my mindfulness can really increase. I can see so much more deeply. And there's many stories just to begin this talk on what that means in real life. Most people's mindfulness is workable, but it doesn't penetrate deeper into the reality of things. One of the first experiences of that, of penetrating deeper, being able to see and hear things which most times I couldn't do, was the first first meditation retreat which I practiced I gave myself to the retreat. I didn't actually teach it. Still a student. And we were allowed this walk every morning, just for an hour, before breakfast. And because this retreat was held in the university town where I studied, I knew the town very well. And I knew we were close to the botanical gardens in this English city. And I spent 8 of those 9 mornings walking to the botanical gardens, maybe a 5-minute walk to the gate. But then what happened when I walked inside those botanical gardens, went through the gate, was something which stunned me. Because there was this clump of bamboo at this entry to the gate. And even the first morning, I would get up early, do lots of meditation before, you know, going on this walk alone in silence. When I saw this clump of bamboo, it was beautiful. The most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life. And I started to imagine why bamboo was always featured in classical Chinese watercolors. It's because its shape and the way that it bends under its own weight. It's tall, long, and very slender, and you'd almost call it like sensual to the eyeball, and the colors. And it was very, very refined. And I saw this clump of bamboo just swaying in the gentle morning breeze with the greens and the yellows of the trunk. And just the slender leaves, you know, thick at the base and then going to this wonderful point. And the whole of the bamboo just captivated my attention. And I did have enough other mindfulness to realize if somebody had seen me just staring at this clump of bamboo early in the morning, they probably would have thought I was on some drugs and taken me away. But there was a seat, a park bench close by. So I sat on that park bench and just stared at the clump of bamboo until I realized I'd have to go back to get my breakfast. And I went back there the following day. 8 out of the 9 days, I went to see the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in my life. And every day I just stand there or sit there and say, I'm never done with that clump of bamboo. I never finished exploring it. After 50 minutes, you'd have to tear yourself away to go and have your breakfast. And I never realized what was happening to me. I had some wonderful meditation on that retreat. The first experience of a deep meditation was on that retreat. But I didn't really understand why or what to make of it. But what happened next was a couple of days after finishing the retreat, back to university with all the socializing, the talking, the studying, all that busyness, I kept thinking of the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world. I just wanted just to go and visit. And when I got on my bicycle and cycled through the traffic to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens, the back entrance, and I went in there to see my most beautiful clump of bamboo, I was shocked. Because what I saw was this dry, desiccated, thin, dusty plant which did not belong in that part of UK or even that part of the world. And it shocked me because all the beauty had gone. All the slenderness, the colours, I just could not see them anymore. Even though my eyes were fine, they were normal, but there was something which was missing, which took away its beauty. And that was one experience of many I had doing meditation. Because when your meditation gets very deep and powerful, you can start to see beauty. You can start to taste flavors which you haven't tasted before in the food you eat. You can start to hear sounds which are far more melodic and soothing than you've ever noticed before. Those sounds are there all the time, but you only hear a fraction of them. And to feel with your hands or with your body sensations which are like amplified, which you're not aware of in your normal states of consciousness. Your mindfulness is getting powerful. And that's one of the reasons why, that when, you know, you are on a retreat, we have these beautiful places where you can meditate. And sometimes I've seen other meditators do this. I've done it myself so often. Just you stand for half an hour or an hour, just looking at just a little blade of grass. You can't imagine just how beautiful that blade of grass is. You've never seen it like that before. The greens, it's like it's been polished. Like it's, and all the dust, the dirt has been taken away, and it's clear, powerful, and very, very gorgeous to watch. And that's just a blade of grass. Or sometimes in Jhana Grove, the meditation retreat center, which we have next to our monastery, sometimes you can sit on the stupas, they're called, these monuments, you know, which were offered by some very generous Indonesian monk and its followers for our retreat center. You can sit on there and just look at the sky at night. And it's clear, there's very little visual pollution. You can see the stars, and the stars are just like all polished. And this is not going crazy or mad. As a monk, we don't take drugs or alcohol. What happens is our mind becomes very clear. And this is what you see. And this is, I said last night, from William Blake's wonderful little poem, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour." This is where all those boundaries are being removed. A clump of bamboo in the fens of London, they're not supposed to look beautiful. It's the wrong climate for them. And the same as just a blade of grass. It's just a blade of grass, for goodness sake. But when you're very mindful, it becomes gorgeous. Because it's gorgeous, you stay with it. You can't pull your attention away. You don't want to pull your attention away. And that gorgeous aspect gets even stronger. And you go around with big silly smiles on your face. And all those boundaries come down. To see a world in a grain of sand, you're not supposed to see a world in a grain of sand. A grain of sand is ordinary. You see the extraordinary in it. You're transcending the boundaries of perception. See a heaven in a wildflower. You know, we have wildflower season here in Perth, in West Australia. And they're tiny little flowers. And most people, if you're not looking, if you're not still, if you're not peaceful, if you haven't trained your mindfulness, you don't see their absolute wonderful colors and how just pretty they are. They're just like daffodils, crocuses, roses. Roses are big and maybe gross, or like orchids. But these are even more beautiful. They're tiny. But you allow your mind to settle on them, and they are just, wow. This is such showing that your mind is transcending. And to hold infinity in the palm of your hand. Now that's what transcendence is. infinity is not a concept, it's not an idea, it's an emotion. No boundaries. You're not limited anymore. All those things which measure and control, which makes things finite, are gone past. This is one of the reasons why that controlling, which many people realize is a big problem in our world, all comes from measuring. When you measure, then you have the means to control, and you have the incentive to control. You measure first, and then you control. It's one of the reasons why that little quote, which somebody actually here in this hall many years ago asked me, and I don't know why they asked me this question, but it was a wonderful question because it was an answer which I never expected. The question was that, what do you think about Lord Kelvin, who was a pioneer scientist, his saying that before we control nature in our world, we have to learn how to measure her accurately first of all. And this was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. To get standard weights and measurements and clocks, so when we could measure our world, measure nature precisely, then we could have control. And when we stop measuring, we go beyond measuring. Then we are free. Free from boundaries. Free from control. We can't do anything. Yay! How peaceful and beautiful that is. When we go beyond, we transform our lives from measuring, judging, weighing. How much time is this talk? How much time do you meditate? How long can you meditate? You know, when I was a young monk, I used to do stuff like that. See how long I can meditate for. See if I can break my PB, personal best. I would be measuring, and the meditation would never be really peaceful then. But there comes time in your meditation, and many of you have experienced this. You meditate there and you get really, really peaceful. And when you open your eyes, you haven't fallen asleep. You had a wonderful time. There's no doubt about that. Because after you've had a really good meditation, you're just full of energy. If you've fallen asleep, you're dull. That's one of the best ways, rules of thumb if you like, to know if you've been asleep when you've been meditating or you've had a very deep one. How much energy and joy have you had got afterwards? And quite frankly, that if you had a very deep meditation, afterwards it's like you're walking on air. You're just so light-hearted, you're so joyful. And that's a sign. Your meditation was really, really transformational. Really deep. So, this is where even time now is not measured. See a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. Basically, an hour has no more meaning. Even a moment has no meaning. Time has vanished. You've gone past time. You don't measure it anymore. It's just a simple thing which I noticed, that when you're meditating, if you're wondering how many minutes have gone past, you're wondering about how many minutes are left, you're measuring things, you can't be peaceful. If you forget time, you're not interested in time anymore. Then you can meditate so peaceful and just 10 minutes or an hour or 5 hours or whatever. It just is. And you're free of time. Time is a prison. I think we all know just the worst parts of time. But imagine that you're not bound by time. You're just peacefully in this moment, enjoying every part of this moment. And you open your eyes and, oh, crikey, a couple of days have gone past. That happens. So sometimes, that when we learn how to not measure things, then we go past things. We can get very, very, very peaceful. But you know that sometimes what happens when people's mindfulness gets that strong, they get afraid. The fear comes up in their meditation. And that stops them going past things. And they stop transcending because they don't want to. The sense of self gets challenged, or their ideas, their comfort zones, they don't want to get beyond them. Which is one of the reasons why that in any spiritual life, it always comes to those parts where we do get afraid. When they do get afraid, first of all, yeah, well done. It means you're challenging some of your old ways of looking at things, your old perceptions. But if you look very carefully, the origin of such fear is a fear of letting go of something. It's a fear of going beyond something which you don't own anyway, a place where you don't really belong. Why are you afraid? Afraid is always when our attachment, something which we delight in, is being taken away from us. Like taking away an ice cream from the little kid. And of course, it's my ice cream, you can't take it away. When you remove the idea it's yours, the ownership, the attachment, the sense of self, it doesn't matter. And little by little, you can let go of more with no fear. What usually happens is the first time you feel a little bit afraid, somehow or other you go beyond that. And as a teacher, it's part of my job, is to try and encourage you to just transcend even small things. And I often quote this little anecdote, the time when I was teaching just a very short meditation in Singapore, a lunchtime meditation to many business people. They had enough confidence in me, they took half an hour off during their lunch hours and came to a meditation class. Don't know how many, maybe I think a couple of thousand. And all businessmen and women. And during their meditation, about half an hour, that's all. Though afterwards, one of them put their hand up and said, that was scary. So what happened? They said, because their hands vanished. They couldn't feel their hands. Ah, what's going on? And it was just a simple example that when you're meditating, your body disappears. You go inside and the body's quite happy. It's just very comfortable, very at ease. But of course, having taught this, done this for so many years, when your body disappears, or just parts of the body disappears, because your body is relaxed, your mind is at peace, oh, it's amazing just how many therapeutical benefits that has. How you just heal yourself. How big diseases disappear. How that one little girl, just how she straightened up her own spine, which was deformed. Brilliant stuff, how cancers, tumours just disappear. How arthritis just goes. Just how you can take a disease like food poisoning. Or how you can take not diseases, but simple things like colds. And I remember one of the best talks which I ever gave. It wasn't a good talk because of the content of the talk. It was an inspiring talk because of just the circumstances of giving the talk. It was the first time when I visited Canberra, so many years ago. And I didn't do research, we didn't have computers in those days. I didn't realize just how cold Canberra could be. It's supposed to be Australia, it's supposed to be warm. But anyway, there's people who are supposed to be kind to me, but they were trying to do their best, but they took me touring around and outside of Canberra and up and down, and it was getting more and more late, and I was supposed to give a talk that evening. And by the time I got to the talk, I'd been out all day, really busy, talking to people, going places, and I developed a cold. And my nose was streaming, you know, with the stuff which happens when you have a cold. The snot was just coming out, just lots of it. My eyes were watering, and I was coughing as well. I was really sick. And usually when you're sick, you just say, okay, I'm just going back and going to bed or something. But all these people had come for this talk in Canberra. And there's something about me that said, oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, you can do something for these people. I tried to give a talk. It was one of the worst talks which I'd given. It only took about 15 minutes, or less than that, 10 minutes. Because he had such a bad cold. All this, you know, terrible, yucky stuff was coming out of your nose and going into your mouth and trying to wipe it away and sneezing and saying another couple of words. And you couldn't put more than a sentence together at a time. And so I just asked everybody, is it okay if we meditate for half an hour first? And they all agreed. And that half an hour was all I needed. I know how to meditate, I know how to go inside, to go very deep. And I had to. Sometimes it's just the incentive is the fact that I don't want to harm anybody or disturb people or disappoint them. So just half an hour is all I needed. When I came out of that meditation, I gave this perfect talk. But not one sneeze. Nothing was coming out of my nose. No coughing. My eyes were clear. And I knew that. So no, that was really unusual. That was transcending something. Transcending the cold. It just disappeared. Not taking any medication. Couldn't even get a cup of English tea. Had some Chinese tea, I think, there. And so no energy, but the energy came back. And the health was just there. I've done that many times. Just how wonderful the ability is to understand just how through stillness and strong mindfulness, when you let the body be still, you transcend your body, how it becomes really healthy. Wow. What a great gift that is. It's one of the reasons I teach that, to encourage everybody, each one of you, you can do that too. And I just told this story just yesterday, last night, to these Buddhists over in Monash University in KL. And it was the story of that book which I wrote, Opening the Door of Your Heart. And the wonderful gift which somebody gave me because of that book. This woman arrived, elderly woman, arrived in Bodhinyana Monastery for lunch. And she was old and she was carrying this, probably the most well-used copy of my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I'd ever seen. You know when you've used a book a lot? It's all dog-eared, it's grey on the outside, and there's creases in the front cover. And she'd been using this book so much. And when I asked her who she was, she said that she'd come from Switzerland, from the city of Bern, B-E-R-N-E. And the reason she'd come, she'd arrived that morning in the airport in Perth, and she got a taxi to Bodhinyana Monastery, and she, you know, waited until our lunchtime, and she came up to see me, and she said, I come all the way from Switzerland just to see you and thank you and ask you to sign my book for me. Would you do that? And of course, I did that. And she wept. She's crying a lot. And I asked why. And she said that she'd had these terrible diseases, like many people, not one disease, many sort of associated diseases, you know, the cancers, anxiety, depression, well, I don't know what else she had. And she said that all of the therapeutic advice, counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists, medical specialists, all of them hadn't helped at all. But that book had. She said that book saved her life. And she just wanted to see me, thank me. And after signing the book, she got in her taxi and returned to Perth Airport and got the next flight back to Switzerland. And to me, that was just wow. That was something which you never expected. There's some power in those teachings, especially healing powers, which transcended anything that I've expected, and it actually worked. It wasn't just me just blissing out in deep meditations or being able to see a blade of grass and, oh, wow, that's so gorgeous. But it was being able to share that with others and to see how much it helped. It's huge. But anyway, how that works is you do get fear at first. What's going on? It doesn't make sense. And sometimes that stops people innovating, understanding, transcending. That is our problem. So little by little, we learn how to see things not the way that others teach us. We see things just transcend all of those ideas and see it very deeply and powerfully. It's one of those little symbols which I use. This, a piece of stick. I don't have many visual aids, so you know, you don't have a screen which you can pull down and have PowerPoints. So just pick up whatever you've got here. And this, which I picked up now, is actually the gong bonger, for want of a better word. But I did this similarly once when I got invited to the 2019 World Computer Conference in Daejeong, South Korea. That was really such a nice gig. World Computer Conference. What they're inviting Ajahn Brahm there for. I don't know much about computers, but I know about innovation. Seeing things which other people haven't seen. That's one of the reasons why they really loved my 15-minute talk, keynote address at the very beginning of the conference, to set the tone, something different. And they liked it, some of them had already given me business class tickets to go all the way from Perth to South Korea, a nice hotel. And they gave Buddhist Society of West Australia 2,000, I think it was 2,000 US dollars as a thank you. Nice little earner, as they say where I came from. But I picked up a water bottle. We don't allow water bottles here anymore, plastic ones. I said, what is this? What is the thing which I'm holding up? So doing this exercise here, say a piece of wood, gong bong, it's brown, it's maybe 8 inches or 9 inches long, it's cylindrical. Yay, come on, say some more. And little by little, you run out of ideas. Everything you've been taught at school, university, by anybody about what this is, you've said that already. Keep looking. Look deeper. Transcend all of those ideas and labels you've had before. It's not doing this in theory, it's actually doing it. And as you look deeper and deeper and deeper, you keep on looking. More ideas come up. Different ways of seeing things. It's a bit scary because you don't know where you're going to finish. You don't know what you're going to find. And it might be challenging for you because all the things you've said are all the things you've been taught, all the things which your culture has approved. And now you can actually see it in a different way. You are transcending the boundaries of your knowledge. That is innovation. But again, you go past that fear simply because I always say the fun of it, just a pull of seeing new things. It seems to be part of the human condition that we always want to, when we see, don't touch the wet paint. We have to touch it. Don't walk on the grass. We have to walk on it. We have to test it out. We have to go a little bit deeper. We're not just going to believe what other people say. We're going to test it. Transcend the boundaries. That is sometimes scary. But even in little things in life, those of you who have had relationships, marriages, or long-term partnerships, and it doesn't work out, and it hurts so much when you break up or divorce, what are you going to do now? Ask that question many times, and sometimes you have a choice. You can put your heart in a concrete bunker, so you won't hurt anymore, but you're not alive anymore either. Or you can get out there and see what happens again. But I'll be hurt again. You know, sometimes life means you are hurt. Life is sometimes dukkha. But we're willing to give it a try, just to see how we can take our understandings, our life, deeper. And sometimes it's that urge to go deeper, to challenge boundaries, which takes us past that fear. But it's also just the sheer joy of it. I mentioned this before, that you know sometimes when you get these deep meditations, this is a simile which I got from years and years ago, about the really powerful meditation, sadhanas, where you really are transcending. You're going way beyond this world. Not into some space world, but deep inside of it. And that is when you're just almost standing on the edge of jhanas. You're really peaceful, very still, lots of bliss. And you realize the next step is you really be letting go of a lot. Huge amount. All you're letting go of is of your identity, who you think you are, your personal existence. That's what it seems like. But you have enough awareness that what's going to happen next is going to be amazing, incredibly blissful, the joy, the love, the acceptance, the freedom. What do? I can't. Oh, it'd be so nice. I can't. Oh, but it's so wonderful. Oh, what the hell, I'm going for it. And sometimes it pulls you in. You just can't resist it, even though it's fearful at first. But when you go past that fear, it's freedom. A simile for that, which is quite accurate. When a prisoner has been in jail for 30, 40, 50 years. Imagine the prisoner is told by the authorities that tomorrow they're going to be free, then go outside of jail. I can't. I don't know how to live in freedom. So many prisoners won't like to be released. And it's like a human being, you've been in prison in the world of the five senses. Now you can be free. No, I don't want to go. That was just like that gentleman who was, his hand started to disappear. Small thing, but that terrified him. He had enough understanding to know that maybe the whole body might disappear. The person he identified with, maybe his knowledge might disappear. Maybe his attainments in degrees. Who he thought he was might disappear. But this, we're going to transcend, all of that has to vanish. Our personal achievements, who we think we are, and to come into this deep state of bliss. And it's become like the jhanas. This is where the five senses stop for a while. And you're in the realm of the mind. Just mind, nothing else. Beautiful mind. And it's such a beautiful pleasure. Everything which you thought was pleasurable before is nothing. As intense, as peaceful, as pure. As something even like the first jhana, which many people take to be union with God. Perfect peace, bliss, love. You understand why people say that, because after a while, if you don't go any further, that's what you conclude. But after a while, that morphs into a second jhana, where there's no will left for you. Choice. I was reading an article which somebody sent me from The Guardian about free will. So many philosophers arguing about it. But we haven't experienced like those deep meditations. You don't argue anymore, you've got direct knowledge of the ending of will. Choice. All gone. And that is real freedom. It's not that other people have power over you, there's no power left. Just bliss, deep power. And these are the sorts of things where you do transcend and you really learn from experience not to be so afraid. And as you transcend even further, I just was going to say, the joy of those jhanas, there was a beautiful saying that the joy of letting go, nekama, renunciation. What are you renouncing? What are you letting go of? Your five senses and you, your identity. And little by little you go deeper and you let even go of the knowing as well. That starts to disappear next. And that challenges you. Challenges you right to the core. You are transcending. Your identification with being this body, with being a boy or a girl, or being transgender, or being anything. Being a monk, being a nun, being a layperson, you're transcending everything. And little by little, you just see everything subject to disappearing, dissolution, until there's nothing left. That is the most challenging for people. Empty, gone, nothing left at all. So many, many people get afraid. Many people say, well, is this a point of Buddhism and meditation just so you can vanish and disappear? Yeah. Well, I don't want to be a Buddhist anymore. You can't resist. Sorry, it's too late. To transcend, to go beyond is something which keeps pulling at you. You can't resist. And soon you transcend all of this. And with it, all of the suffering and the wanting and the doing. Because all of this, you cannot want it. To transcend one of the biggest things which you're going beyond is wanting anything. What do you want? Have you ever noticed the more you want, the more stress you have in life? The more you try and get things, there's the more work you have to do. And when you don't get what you want, you get upset. It causes you the ill will. When all of that vanishes, oh, freedom at last. Freedom, the taste of freedom. And that bliss of the first jhana even was called Sambodhi Sukha. Enlightenment, happiness. It's not enlightenment, but it's so close. It's got the taste of Nibbana, freeing. So little by little, you get pulled into these deep meditations. In these deep meditations, those hindrances are gone. They come back later, but much weaker. Which is one of the reasons why your mindfulness is incredibly powerful. And sometimes, when people talk about mindfulness training, I don't know really what they're talking about. The real deep mindfulness training, when the mindfulness, you can feel it growing stronger and more powerful, more intense, and to see deeply into things. Really see deeply into it. It only comes from the great stillness of the mind, the power of the mind, the joy of the mind. You can feel things like psychic powers and stuff, all this weird stuff. Sometimes you can feel that power. And sometimes, why not? Sometimes, well, there's too many people around. So sometimes you can feel these things, you are transcending. You're transcending you. You are vanishing, going beyond and disappearing. Gone. So that's how we transcend things. There's so many beautiful benefits on the way. The more you go, the more free you are. Go a little bit, and you're certainly healthy and happy. And whatever you do in this world, you do have innovation. You do have happiness and power and good health. That's not bad. So anyway, that's the talk for this evening on transcendence. So now we can have some questions maybe. If there are any. So those here, we usually say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's see what we've got here. Okay, seven questions. Here we go. I'll try and be brief with the answers, not to take up too much time. Nipuni from UK. How to draw the line between letting go and caring? Example, in a relationship we worry about a partner's well-being and it can be stressful. It is stressful. Remember, in a relationship it's not about you, it's not about your partner, it's about us. And that's just changing the whole idea of relationships. Look, it's, you know, some of these stories about relationships, why do they ask someone like me? I haven't been married. But still, people with marriage problems, they come and ask me. So that's when I say, look, the person when the people get married, this example, then I look at the bride. They ask me to do marriage blessings. Why the heck do they want me to do a marriage blessing when I've never been married? Anyway, I look at the bride and say, from now on, you're a married woman, you must not think of yourself. Yes, she thinks, nods her head. You, the guy, you're the married man, you must not think of yourself. Yes. Then still looking at the guy, now you're married, you must not think of her, your wife. From this day on, don't think of your wife. And look at the wife, from this day on, you must not think of your husband. You managed to get out, escape. Bye-bye. You must not think of your husband. Because once you're married, you must not think of yourself, you must not think of your partner. You must only think of us. You're in it together. It's about us. So, when you're in a relationship, please care for us. Not for yourself, not for your partner, but for us. You're in it together. And then, if you're worrying about your well-being, you're not caring for anybody. You've got to care for our well-being. Then the stress gets reduced. From India, there's a part of the mind that just grasps or latches onto things like the will and wants. Just telling it to let go doesn't seem to work. What is this part of the mind grasping? It is, your idea of a self, which then makes the illusion of wanting and controlling and stuff, which is one of the reasons why that the only way that you can experience this is to not to tell your mind what to do, is through kindness. opening the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now, being aware of this moment and being kind to it. And little by little, you calm down, you get very still. And as you get very, very still, you find that letting go of things is just beautiful. And it encourages you to let go of more and more and more. And that is where the grasping stops. Not through telling it, but through letting nature let go. How to deal with feelings of inadequacy. It is very hard in these times for our society to love our bodies and feel we're enough. I always hear comments about my body that make me feel less of a woman. How can I deal with these comments and remain confident? Is look at yourself, look at other people. There's nothing which you are lacking. And one of the nicest ways of feeling confident is actually to just go out into a forest. It's the old story, the most beautiful tree in the forest is not the one which is perfect. I live in forests, forest tradition monk. And the trees in the forest which I like are the ones which are all bent, twisted, crooked, and the bark is all marked and damaged. Those are the beautiful trees. Go into a forest and find a beautiful tree and you find it's not perfect. It's twisted, bent and damaged. Then you can understand the way you look at yourself. You're looking at yourself in truth, not the way that other people look at you. Other people haven't got a clue who you are, what you're doing. So you look at yourself and see its beauty. The nice thing about those damaged trees, they all belong in the forest. And the damaged ones, the most damaged and the most beautiful, the one I like to sit underneath. So, in our society, to love our bodies, love your body, the beautiful damaged body you have, twisted and bent. See it as beautiful. Get different ideas of what perfection is. Could you please tell me the Buddha's thinking about transgender people? I ask because I haven't come across much information, thank you. Transgender people, I'm going to change that word around. You're a person who's transgender. You're a person first. You're part of this wonderful, again, forest, which has so many different types of trees, and all of them are welcome. You're a person first, a living being. And when this Asian couple who were Buddhists, they emailed me and said, we just found out our son is gay. What should we do? I said, what do you mean, what should you do? To love him to bits. Now, don't you always say, may all beings be happy and well? Your son is a being. Give him that respect and happiness and well-being. That's what you've been chanting every day. So, love. Whatever being comes in front of you. What was it? Lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, IA. Sometimes I'm getting a bit tired now, forgetting all the words. LGBTQIA+. Love everybody. So, you're a transgender person, welcome. We have many transgender people over in our Buddhist society, of West Australia. They're just welcome just because we're trying to be cool or woke or something. They're welcome because they're human beings. Welcome. May I know how to let go of stubbornness, that things have to be done in a certain way? Well, just every now and again, have sort of 1 hour a day, which is rebellious time. So you don't do things in a certain way, you do it differently. I said this years and years ago. If you do things in the same old way, you're stubborn about it, you get very dull. And you get boring. So I actually do this, even today. I decided when you brush your teeth in the morning, evening, or whenever you do it, where do you start when you brush your teeth? However you started today, start in a different place tomorrow. And start a different place every day of the week. Sometimes the top and middle, sometimes inside, bottom, or whatever. In other words, challenge your habits. Do it slightly differently. And even when people are doing meditation retreats, I said, don't always sit in the same place. Sit somewhere else. I have to sit in the same place because that's where the cameras are. It's focusing on me. But sit in a different way. Don't always sit in the same place. And then you don't get bored. You get more alive. You're more aware. So don't be so stubbornness. Try doing things in a different way, and you become just do a little bit of different way, and you find out you feel more alive, and you also just feel more joy in life doing things a slightly different way. Is it possible to manage or cure personality disorders and mental illnesses like bipolar personality, anxiety, depression, etc., with mindfulness and meditation, without any professional help? Yeah, of course, easy. See it in a different way. There is no person I've ever met who has personality disorder. No person's got mental illness. No person's bipolar. No person who's got anxiety or depression. They're a person who sometimes shows symptoms or behavior which people say are bipolar or personality disorder or whatever. More measuring and control. Instead, say you've got depression. Instead of getting depressed about depression, you have depression, be with it. Be kind to it. Get to understand and know it. But not with measuring it, but with respecting it. When you respect depression, when it comes into you, you'll find there's many times when you're not depressed at all. And little by little, when we focus on the positive side of ourselves, that grows and takes over. That was the teaching which I was so respected from the head of the professor of schizophrenia unit in Singapore Mental Health. Professor, he was a Catholic. But I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? And I always remember this conversation because he said, just as you explained, Ajahn Brahm, I don't treat schizophrenia in a schizophrenia unit of the mental health campus. I think it was in Woodlands, over in the north part of Singapore. And I said, yeah? What do you treat then? He said, the other part of that patient. I treat the part which is not schizophrenic. And I understood what he was talking about. I said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. What's the results? He said, so much better than classical treatment. There's no such thing as a schizophrenic. It's a person who has episodes which we recognize as schizophrenia. Treat the other part of them, and that grows. All those times which I went into prisons to teach, never ever saw a criminal. Never ever saw a murderer, a rapist, a thief. I saw many people who had stolen, even people who had murdered. I never saw a murderer. They were much bigger than that terrible, hurtful crime for which they were put in jail. Person, schizophrenic, no. They're people who have episodes of schizophrenia. But they're much bigger than that. Water the flowers, don't water the weeds. From Indonesia, dear Ajahn, what do you suggest someone who is still working, earning for a living, but really wants to practice and learn Dhamma? Yes, that's what we have monasteries for. Unfortunately, it's just sometimes so hard to build monasteries. And yes, I've been doing this most of my life. I'll now give it to other people to build monasteries. I've got 6 new huts at Bodhinyana Monastery. They haven't been finished yet. Such a hard amount of work. Venerable Radha does lots of the electrical work on those 6 huts. But I guarantee as soon as they're finished, they'll be full. What are we going to do? I don't know. But anyway, we'll see what happens. But still working, earning for a living, but really wants to practice and learn Dhamma. Simplify your life. You don't need that much to live. You don't have to wear, you know, expensive clothes. You don't have to go traveling overseas, you know, for holidays. A small house, small flat, small apartment. Keep it tiny. And then you don't have to eat expensive food. That means you can live very frugally. That's what you can do in the meantime until there's a possibility to live as a monk or a nun. Simple, peaceful, beautiful. And all those monks and nuns living now, working very hard to try and make the opportunity available for others. Remember this, there comes a time in your life when you need to go and retreat for yourself. Take that opportunity. Bliss out, become really peaceful. Why not? You can do it. Okay, so there we go, that's the 7th question. Any questions from the audience here? Okay, so there we are. That's the talk and questions for today. Thank you for listening. Hope it was okay. So if it wasn't, well, never mind. You know, I gave this talk to the people over, to some of the Thai people. I gave a retreat, only 3 days, and people give me some feedback. So, oh, the wonderful retreat. And there's a lot, you've been teaching some deep teachings to the Thai community here. They loved it. When can you do it again? So it's nice if it's, people enjoy it. But, you know, it's only a limit to the number of times you can do these things. So anyway, now we can actually do respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go back to where we need to go. Oops, sorry, I'm stuck. There we go.
Arahaṁ Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhaṁ Bhagavantaṁ Abhivadami Suvakkato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṁ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangha Namami.